Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
All righty. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really amazing conversation in front of us. You know, we are going to be speaking with a founder that has done it, you know, a couple of times with his first company. Actually, you know, he sold it to Dell. Then Dell sold it for $4 billion. I mean, it's kind of like unbelievable the value that they were able to create there. And now, you know, he's embarked in a rocket ship and we're going to be talking about it as well. So again, brace yourself for a really incredible conversation. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Rick Nucci. Welcome to the show.
Hello, hello. Thank you so much for having me. Excited to chat with you.
So born in Pennsylvania. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up over there?
Oh boy, yeah. Well, you know, there's an Amish country in Pennsylvania, and that's sort of where I'm from. I'm Italian based on my last name. That might be obvious, but yeah, sort of grew up outside of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and really was there my whole life until I went to college, and moved to Philadelphia in 1999, and have been here ever since. And actually, have had plenty of moments to maybe move or do a startup in a more predictable tech hub or something like that. But actually, I've become an enormous fan, enthusiast of Philadelphia. I think it's a wonderful city. So, I actually love living here and do it by choice.
How was it like for you to have both parents entrepreneurs, and how was it like to be able to experience the going through the cycles for them?
Yeah. And, you know, look, for those that have been on the journey, I mean, there's plenty of ups and downs. It's never the way it's reported about and the breakout stories we read. It's always that squiggly line with lots of ups and downs. And that's what it was like. But I would say it normalized the experience for me. It felt like this is something that people often do. And both of my parents, my father bought a small business and ran it and grew it for, I don't know, most of my life that I remember, can think about, that's what he was doing. And then my mom also opened a retail store in a mall in the area where we grew up. That was sort of tied to the other business. And like, that was like what they did. And so it was great. And it had like everything. It had its ups and its downs. But I would say for me, it made me feel, as moments came up and I was like, look, I think I want to start something. You know, it didn't feel maybe as foreign to me as it otherwise might.
So then in your case, you know, like you went to college and then, you know, it sounds like you went to work for another company versus like starting your own. I mean, what happened there? What were you waiting for?
I think I was figuring out what the heck I wanted to do. I mean, I went to Penn State University and my major was business logistics. And about halfway through, I was like, oh no, I'm actually interested in technology much more. It was the first moment of like an area of, you know, career work where I felt a draw or a pull. And so long story short, rather than like changing majors or going through all that, I went to work for a logistics software company. It was really an ideal combination. I don't know that I thought about it that way at the time, but it was an ideal combination of being able to get myself into technology while still leveraging my major. So that was what I did. And so it wasn't like in college, I was sitting here going, when am I going to start, you know, my first company, as much as like, wow, technology is fascinating. You know, I'm a big music guy. So like, I just bought all my music on cdnow.com and I just made some, you know, I clicked around and these things showed up at my house. Like I'm all in. This is amazing and revolutionary. And then it kind of went from there. But I only was at that company for 2 years, saw the pain of integration firsthand, which is what Boomi does, saw that firsthand. And with two other coworkers at that company, we left and started Boomi. So that was in 2000. So I really was only working at another company for 2 years. I was 24 years old when we started Boomi. You know, we go visit customers. I couldn't even rent a car yet, you know, but like, you know, zero regrets. I mean, quite the opposite. Really, really fortunate that I ended up doing that and kind of jumping into the pool, so to speak, at such a young age, because I think I just, my rate of learning, I feel like just skyrocketed.
So let's talk about Boomi, because I mean, Boomi was quite a success. I mean, you guys ended up going through an acquisition with Dell, but you were talking about like leaving as an employee, you know, the company that you were working at with your co-founders and starting this other company. So how was that transition, you know, that sequence of events that needed to happen for you to be like, it's time to get this thing done. It's time to take ownership of my own future.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it was this build up series of conversations with my two coworkers, this growing energy of like, yeah, we should do this. This kind of mutual encouragement, like, hey, we should take the plunge and do this. And this was that we were observing the problem of integration firsthand. I mean, look, forever in the enterprise, companies of all sizes, you have to connect data between these different systems. You have to do it in an automated way. The systems literally don't work. They don't run unless they are properly integrated together. That's a very well-known thing. But the way it was being done back then, broadly speaking, was people were just writing code. It was very relative to today, primitive technology. But it was very cumbersome. It was always the problem whenever the logistics software that I was working at was being deployed to customers. Integration was always what the problem was. It was always the issue. It was always the like reason the customer go live was getting delayed or whatever. And we're like, man, this is a product opportunity. This is what we should do. And so it was the combination of like observing the pain firsthand, thinking the, hey, there's got to be a better way feeling. And then the sort of like mutual encouragement with this core group of folks where we were like, hey, let's like actually do something about this. And so that combination, I think, jumped us, you know, jumped us into the world of starting our own business.
So then walk us through the journey of Boomi, because also with Boomi, I mean, what was the business model there? How were you guys making money? I think that's for the people that are listening to get it.
Totally. I mean, Boomi started its life as an on-premise software sold with a perpetual license with maintenance. The way software used to be sold back then, again, we started in 2000. We had our first paying customer in 2001, and that was the business. And the we call that Boomi 1.0. And the real challenge and the learning that's just been seared into my brain forever, and I think we're seeing it play out now in the AI world in a different but analogous way, is as we got into this space, there was never a question that it's a must-have product, ever. This is a must-solve problem. Businesses must integrate their software together. That's known and obvious. What we realized when we got into it was, wow, there's 100 companies doing some version of this. Very, very crowded market. It was, I think, without having any foresight into the market, heating up in a big way in this time period. And that's great, but also was really, really hard to stand out. And like, I remember Microsoft launching a product called BizTalk in 2001 that was very, very competitive. And we're like, yeah, this is probably not great. And Boomi struggled, I think, as a result of that for several years in this, how do we stand out? We're a smaller startup. We were competing against companies that had raised, you know, $30, $40, $50 million in venture capital. You know, at the time, I think we had raised about $1 million in angel investment. And we, long story short, like, we need to change. And at the same time, what we started to see happen was the beginnings of cloud. I think SaaS really was probably the name that everyone was starting to use back in, you know, 2005, 2006. We were early adopters internally at Boomi of Salesforce.com. We were early adopters of NetSuite. And we were sort of bought into this idea of like, boy, the way on-premise software is sold and delivered is just drastically ineffective and absurdly expensive. And SaaS is going to change all that, et cetera. We said, okay, imagine that happens. And this is really, I think, a blueprint that plays out so many times in tech historically. Imagine that big sea change event happens. That is, you see enterprise software shift from on-premise to cloud. And if that were to happen, how would integration need to work? Because it would be quite different than it would need to work in an on-premise world. When you have everything in one data center, the way you integrate it together is quite different than when you have some things running on-premise, some things running in the cloud, connecting different clouds together, et cetera. So we said, okay, we're going to create a brand new product that assumes that future is true, And we called that product IPaaS, our IPaaS product, Integration Platform as a Service. And we launched that product in 2007. And that was way early. I mean, like, you know, we talk to customers and they'd be like, well, I'm like, I got Salesforce, but, you know, I don't really have a whole lot of like SaaS stuff to be like connecting up, right? So we were definitely early to market, which was a strength and a weakness. I think the weakness was we really needed to learn how to find those early adopters. The way that we did that was we partnered with other SaaS companies. And by partnering with those SaaS companies, as they were selling, you know, SuccessFactors, Taleo, Salesforce.com, NetSuite, as they were deploying their products to customers, they had to integrate them. And so it sort of created this natural pull for us. Great. But the strength of being that early was it gave Boomi the ability to be sort of the, you know, category recreator, reinventor, what used to be called enterprise application integration, the on-premise days, got reinvented as integration platform as a service. Gartner finally published a magic quadrant. Boomi was very top right. And that really, really took off, you know, Boomi. And then in 2010, we were acquired by Dell. And Dell was really looking to get into the software world and go beyond hardware. And that drove them to acquire Boomi as an asset. So I'll pause there. But that was I think that shift and transformation and bet has guided a ton of my thinking, you know, throughout the, you know, next sort of decade and a half of my work.
So walk us through the acquisition. How was that like? Walk us through the process.
Yeah, I mean, in hindsight, it was a very good acquisition. And I say that meaning like I've heard many horror stories. You know, it was a very fascinating experience for me because it was a competitive acquisition. There were two companies competing and bidding on Boomi, and they both sort of manifested organically because we had partnerships with both of them. Dell obviously ended up being the winning one, but it was sort of a fascinating, you know, negotiation. It was certainly stressful, you know, this is your baby kind of thing. So there was a lot of that happening. But Dell had brought in this guy named Dave Johnson, who ran corp dev at IBM before joining Dell, and had done 100 M&A transactions. And you could really feel that through the process because they just had this, you know, they had it down from due diligence to acquisition to promising what they were going to do post-acquisition to following through on those promises to setting up Boomi for success. Of course, there's the, oh, we're part of a huge company annoyances that happen. By the way, Dell told us that. I'll never forget. They set us down, the HR team, and they're like, so everything that you guys are used to doing, expect it to take about 30% longer than it used to take. We're like, okay, good. At the time, I didn't really understand what they meant because I never worked for a company as big as Dell in my life. But afterwards, I'm like, okay, I understand what they mean because there is just stuff. Like you have to do HR differently. You have to do finance differently. You have to do IT differently. You just have to. And so like, sure, if that's like the stuff that's annoying you, talk about a first world problem, right? So good acquirer, good process. They let Boomi run untouched. I remember clearly my bosses at Dell, you know, they were great. And really it was a very autonomous structure. It was like, look, we're gonna fund the business. We want to fuel its growth. We want you guys to run it. We want to protect the culture. And they really did that. And I really was in no rush to leave. And I always named them as a great acquirer, and they really were. And when I did leave, I did it over a 6-month period because I wanted it to be a non-event that the founder was leaving. I didn't want it to be this sort of dramatic thing or have any potential negative impact to Boomi. And so I remember in 2013, January, sitting down and saying like, hey, listen, like I've got to do this thing. I've got to start Guru. I'm just like feeling it, but I'm not in a rush. And so let's sort of assume that by the summertime, I'm kind of phased out. I want to make this easy. I've got my successor already lined up, Chris McNabb, who did a fantastic job running Boomi the next, you know, 10 or so years after I left. And so that was kind of the story. But yeah, looking back on it, it's like great experience, great acquirer. The things that were quote unquote annoying, you know, first world problems, they did right by the Boomi team.
And they ended up selling for a lot of money.
And then fast forward to 2021, they sold it for $4 billion to private equity. And I think that was a phenomenal outcome for Dell and for Michael Dell. And I think it set up Boomi for the growth and the trajectory they are on now, which is really phenomenal. And they are continuing to innovate in the space. They are fully leaning into AI in their world, just like we leaned into cloud in the early chapter of Boomi. And I think it's amazing. And so they now are running as their own independent entity, and I think have huge opportunity ahead of them. Yeah.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So then let's talk about Guru, because, you know, obviously after such a successful, you know, journey, you know, I mean, when Guru, the idea comes knocking, I'm sure that you thought about it, you know, a few times before taking action.
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's the whole, like, if you could go back to high school again, you know, what would you do? Different thing. But I mean, like Boomi, Guru was born out of a personal pain. And what we saw happen at Boomi was knowledge sharing and being able to, you know, allow employees to self-serve, quickly find the answers they need to do their job is actually immensely difficult. It's broken. And you know, it's arguably even harder or even more broken today because of the proliferation of SaaS and the amount of places where knowledge and information is siloed across the company. The way we saw it manifest was internally, it's everything from like, how do I position against a competitor, to how does this new product feature work, to internal process and procedure around HR or IT, right? I think we all can sort of, we all sort of live the pain in our work of needing to find this information and find it quickly and be able to understand if what we're finding is actually accurate. And we just tried using a bunch of products. There were wikis out there and intranets out there. And, you know, our belief is that those categories of software have just failed. They've just failed customers. There are some good, you know, nuggets taken out of them, as happens with all old categories of software. But, you know, we tried using all those. We're like, there has to be a better way, essentially. And that really led us to start Guru and built the, you know, I remember sitting at a Gartner conference. This is like the moment, right? I remember sitting at a Gartner conference and there was a session and it was about an intranet vendor, a big one, a very big one. And the session started and I was sitting in the back because I just wanted to learn at this point because I was like, I think I want to do this, right? And the room was full of customers of this vendor. And up on stage was five Gartner analysts. The vendor wasn't in the room. It was the Gartner analysts and the customers. And the session went off the rails in the first 10 minutes. Whatever agenda they had got completely derailed. And what it became was this very passionate, frustrated energy in the room about the internet and why it wasn't doing what it was supposed to be doing. And when was it going to work in the cloud? And when was this going to happen? And when was that? And I was blown away. I'm like, first of all, the vendor's not even here. Like, these poor Gartner analysts are sitting up on stage, like trying to answer these questions like they're product subject matter experts. It was fascinating. And I walked out of that session and I'm like, that amount of energy and passion around something like an intranet I have to, like, I have to start this company. And like, that was literally like the moment. And started Guru with Mitch Stewart, who's my co-founder and CTO. He and I worked together at Boomi. So we worked together since 2002. He ran all of engineering. We left and started it. And, you know, he was feeling the pain personally as well at Boomi. Yeah, that was sort of the inception moment of like, this has to exist in the world. We have to do this, you know.
So how do you guys make money at Guru? What is the business model there?
So it is a seat-based subscription. So it's very simple pricing and effectively, you know, it tends to be something that is purchased and used by the entire company. So the very predictable math is, you know, how many employees the company has. Sometimes they also deploy Guru to partners or BPOs or folks like that where knowledge sharing is really, really critical. That's effectively going to be the price for Guru. So we really wanted to keep it simple and predictable.
And you've also raised about $70 million, obviously after such a successful exit, you know, to a company like Dell. I'm sure that raising money wasn't that difficult. So how did you go about it? Why did you go about it with the people that you did? And how has it been going through the cycles too on the financing with Guru?
Totally, yes. I feel very fortunate with the investors we have at Guru. We have First Mark Capital, Emergence Capital, Thrive, Excel, really, really strong VC firms with really great partners that are on our board and guide us, and really great networks. You know, Amish Johnny from First Mark led Guru's seed. He also led Boomi's Series A. And I sort of just didn't really shop the seed round and just sort of went right back to him because I just had a good experience with him. I mean, we were, you know, if you think about the years of Boomi, that was during the global financial crisis. There was plenty of tumultuous times. E-spend really got hammered in 2008. Everybody got kind of freaked out and did a lot of, you know, pauses in spending software, a lot like we saw play out in tech in 2022, 2023. That definitely happened. And so when you can see a VC in not great moments and see how they behave and show up, you know, for me, I'm like, yeah, I want to work with this guy again. So yeah, I've been working with Amish since 2008, 2007, I think is probably the first time I met him, and has really been a phenomenal partner because, you know, he's that prototypical investor that is smooth through the storms. He's sort of the calm voice through the crazy things going on. And I just sort of value and appreciate that in him. The experience of fundraising, as you suggested, at Guru was quite different because we had a great outcome at Boomi. Fundraising was just very, very different. The other big difference was geography was a really big thing. And now it is not really a big thing, in my opinion. And what I mean by that is, you know, being in Philadelphia, building a tech company was really a weird thing to do in the early 2000s. And, you know, when we got acquired by Dell, one of the articles, Wired covered it. And the headline of the article was something like, Dell finds its mojo in Philadelphia? Like that's of the whole story they could tell about the acquisition. That's what they focused on, that we're in Philadelphia. It's like, yeah, look, like we actually have internet. We're not all Amish. Like there is some like actual cool stuff going on in Philadelphia. Anyway, but when we were fundraising for Boomi, that was an immediate objection we had to overcome every single time. Philadelphia, you're not in, you know, even New York wasn't considered a viable tech hub yet in 2007, 2008. It was starting to be, right? But it was like, oh, if you're not in the Bay Area, you're not, you know, you're not a viable, you know, option. And we were like, that seems very flawed. So that was hard. That was a lot, you know, a lot of conversations didn't go anywhere simply because we were in Philadelphia. Whereas with Guru, geography really, I would say, is irrelevant in our fundraising journey. And like when Excel led our Series C, they spent a lot of time sitting us down, telling us like, look, by the way, like we funded Spotify, we funded Atlassian, we funded MessageBird, like all these businesses that blew up in quote unquote non-tech hubs, we actually love it. You know, so they had sort of this opposite bias with their growth fund. And so they actually loved that we were in Philadelphia. I think they had recently funded another Philly company, GoPuff. And so anyway, so the geo thing kind of went away. I think that being a second timer went away, but yeah, over the years, really for us, the decision to raise venture capital, you know, we've never been a company that's had what I'd call a, you know, alarming or outrageous burn rate as a business, but we have always believed in the opportunity and ability to leverage venture capital to, you know, subsidize growth to be able to, when we saw something working, when we saw our first sign of product market fit, I think we crossed over $1 million in ARR in 2017. And we were like, okay, it's time for our Series A, because we sort of knew we could spend money, put money to good use, and really double down on those personas we were closing and bringing in. And we sort of played that out through the next, you know, several chapters of our growth. But yeah, I would say I feel fortunate in working with a solid group of investors. Again, you hear a lot of horror stories, and I think for us, it's just been a really positive experience.
So obviously, when you bring on board investors, you know, they're backing on a vision. In order to think about the vision here, you know, if you were to go to sleep tonight, Rick, and you wake up in a world where the vision of Guru was fully realized, what does that world look like?
Yeah, that world looks like you have a AI-centric, you know, assistant that is your, you know, search and research partner in order to do your work. That there is nothing going on at the company that you cannot instantly access and find. And the work to do the work part of your job goes from chore and pain and daily grind down to this is energizing because I'm focusing on the work I was actually hired to do. And we believe that AI, generative AI in particular, and where LLMs are going will allow us to drastically transform how that problem gets solved. And so that is the world. Like, everyone I've ever met that's worked professionally has used an intranet, has used a wiki. I'm not sure I've ever met one that said, that was a great experience. And our goal is that it is a joy, it is a pleasure to be able to use Guru, because it's just going to give you that answer you need, that insight you need, and get you into the work that you're actually trying to get done.
And what about, we talk about the past with a lens of reflection. If I bring you back in time to that moment, you know, that you were still, you know, working as an employee for another company, and right that moment where you were about to make the jump with your co-founders, I would say before, right when you were making that jump and giving the notice, let's say you were able to show up right there with your younger self and be able to give that younger self one piece of advice for launching a business, what would that be and why, given what you know now?
Investing in self-awareness, personal coaching, maybe that could be CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, whatever you want to call it. Any playbook, any founder advice, anything about product market fit, anything about, you know, MVP thinking, all that stuff comes way lower in the list to me than the emotional durability that can be learned and gained. Maybe it's meditation for some, whatever the thing is, it is the hardest thing I've ever pursued in my life to start a business. It is immensely gratifying. It is immensely stressful and at times immensely frustrating. And so it is all about EQ, and not only for myself, but I would also tell myself it matters for me and anybody I'm hiring, certainly the leadership team I want to build out. EQ's got to be top of the list, because how they show up is going to go straight down into the teams that they're building. And I can't tell you the amount of times when we have had the emotional resilience and the awareness as a team to be able to endure really hard moments is mind-blowing to me. And when I see the way this team shows up and handles hard things or bad news or good things or stressful things, they are an even keel, steady team that really doesn't get freaked out, really doesn't get spooked by things. And that to me is the ultimate skill of all skills, because you can, you know, once you've got that down and you're operating in that mindset, you will learn a new thing twice as fast. You will by default be open and curious instead of being closed and critical. And being open and curious sets you up to have a growth mindset, to rethink about old problems in new ways. I mean, you will just process everything. So I would 10 out of 10 forever, any founder in any business at any stage, I would say it is the EQ, the self-awareness, the mental resilience, the wellness and mental wellness and well-being that will be the biggest ROI that you could ever look for.
That's amazing, Rick. So for the people that are listening, Rick, that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
LinkedIn is where I spend most of my time from a social perspective. So you can easily find me on LinkedIn. Just look at Rick Nucci and I will be there and would love to say hi.
Amazing. Well, hey, Rick, well, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an honor to have you with us.
Thank you, Alejandro. I appreciate you.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.